Welcome to Open Sources Guelph on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz of Generation X, who has followed the lead of his generation and gotten the jab, so I'm half-vaxxed, I guess. A little bit of luck, a little bit of flukage, and yeah. So I've joined the ranks of the... You didn't actually know that, Adam, did you? I just dropped that.
Of the half back. Yeah.
So I was a little bit fortunate because it has been a struggle for many. Yet thankful that it's happened. So,
yeah.
Leave it to Gen X to take up the trickle down stuff. You know, that's how we roll. So.
You don't have an Instagram, so that's why I didn't know. You didn't post a selfie on Instagram.
Yes, which is probably also a reflection of my generation, or some of us anyway. And I had a BlackBerry up until recently, but that's another story.
we probably shouldn't go there.
That's a whole nother show, right?
That is another show. Open Source is the CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. We are here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world, and we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, which this week will be Wellington Halton Hills MP and foreign affairs critic Michael Chong, who will talk about the politics of dealing with China, which he knows all about because he's actually been sanctioned by China, and we're going to talk about that and other stuff. That's at the bottom of the hour. Before that, we will talk about the conviction of Derek Chauvin and what that is going to mean for Black Lives Matter and the cause of equal justice going forward. But first, we have to talk about the federal budget, the first federal budget in 25 months.
Wow.
I was going to say I did the math, but it's not that hard. It's you add a month plus 2 years. But the budget came out. It is kind of so boring that nobody's kind of talking about it now, like 3 days later. It was delivered by Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister. First time a woman has delivered a budget. First time because she's the first female finance minister. But all in all, what did she call it? Finish the job against the pandemic budget, something like that.
Sounds like that's the plan to... I can't remember where I read it, but it was, you know, kind of plugging the holes that the pandemic has created, but also... kickstarting the recovery seems to be the plan. I think that's a direct quote. Star, maybe? Probably the Star. Yeah. So at $101.4 billion in new spending, it's quite extensive. What was that thing they used to do when they filibustered, like read the phone book or something? It has that feel to it, 800 pages. I think if you if you still want one, right, you can order one. You don't get a PDF. They will physically send you a copy of this in French and English. So if you want a bunch of paper... like the older generations used to rely on, you can get one and wave it around. Yeah, so it looks like the largest plank is at least attempting to be the provision for childcare, which is to the tune of $30 billion. I believe the word she session was used at least once in those discussions and in the presentation, and the goal being that child care will be offered up to the provinces, I believe with the exception of Quebec, at an average of $10 a day as a cost. The catch is that the provinces will have to buy into this program, and by the grumbling that came out after the budget was released, it sounds like a lot of them probably won't. So as you know, in places like Toronto, it's very... and I would say across the country for that matter, with probably the exception of Quebec, it can be really tough to find childcare. I believe Toronto is the worst, and most of Quebec is the best in terms of filling that gap. So it's been a problem for a long, long time, and this is something that's been brought up in the past. It's like, we need a national childcare program. It's been through many, many governments. Never happened. Well, it's finally happening now. They're taking this opportunity to say, let's roll this out, which will presumably stimulate everything. Whether that's going to happen, I think this may be the big promise that was very wishful thinking, but I personally don't think it's going to amount to anything, mostly because I don't think there's a chunk of provinces, and I think we know who they are, aren't going to buy into this just to say, okay, Trudeau and gang, you've screwed up again. So Well, this
I hate to be a Debbie Downer on this, but it's like they put forward this huge plank and it's like, I don't think that's going to amount to anything.
Well, this is it. I mean, that's always going to be the thing is, unfortunately, there are just certain provincial governments for whom any chance to dunk on the federal government as the font of all their problems, they take it. When that is something good that the government's trying to do, it's like, oh, you're not giving us choice. You're kind of imposing your federal will on us. And then when the federal government doesn't act on things they want, it's like, you're holding us back. You're holding us down. And it's just, it's so like blatantly empty political. And at the end of the day, like $10 per day childcare, like what kind of economic engine does that start up in a world where people are paying $50 a week for childcare instead of God knows how much, right? More money for families to spend, like if you have a family of four and you don't have to spend like $300, $400 a week per child on childcare anymore, that's like $800, and you're not going to put that in a savings account. You're going to be buying, you know, more stuff. You're like more clothes for the kids, more food, like healthier food. You are unleashing an economic beast, and you got to wonder yourself if what's the goal here? Is the goal to help people, or is the goal to screw Justin? And I think the unfortunately, as we see time and time again, the goal is to screw Justin. That's about as helpful as the extra $4 tax on a carton of smokes. Which is also in the budget, a very small part of the budget. But at a certain point, I saw that and I was like, you know, haven't we gotten enough blood from smokers? You know, I mean, I know you are a reformed smoker and some of our listeners may know that, but you just at the same time, I know it's a filthy habit, but come on. Like how much of this are we going to keep putting on the smokers?
Well, that's the thing. Like the sin taxes used to be a big deal because consumption was high, right? Yeah. So the return on a consumption tax was good. It would always be. They would report on the budget and the screaming was about what? Gasoline, alcohol, and cigarette taxes. And now that almost seems, well, not insignificant, but they say, oh, we're going to tax. Taxing a carton of cigarettes doesn't really mean anything anymore. It's small potatoes. And while we're talking about the sort of small potato aspects of the budget, $4 million for the Victims of Communism Memorial. I mean, come on. But people know me and they know I'm not a communist, but this kind of stuff is like, this is just like pure political stuff. Like, where's the money for the, I don't know, the victims of the Ukrainian SS? Like, just that kind of stuff is just let it go. Just make that thing disappear. So there are these kind of small ball things in there. They're like, you're trying to make some kind of statement rather than do the, you know, why not just stick to the big stuff like you'd like to. But, you know, these things are all 800 pages. There's going to be, it's going to get picked apart a little bit. So anyway, but that's just a bit of an aside, I suppose. But yeah, it's like, stay away from the small ball stuff and tell us about, I don't know, your green plan, which was also fairly high on the roster, right?
Yeah, $5 billion for 7 years for green initiatives, including a net zero accelerator, which sounds more awesome than it really is. It's just a way
the broken part on the Enterprise, right? Where's right. The net zero accelerator? Yeah.
it just, you know, it's a way of helping big emitters move to, you know, more clean tech options. There's also a big chunk of change for people who want to do renovations. Like here it is, $4.4 billion worth of interest-free loans with a cap of $40,000 per person. So that you can get like better insulated windows, you know, seal those drafts, get, you know, cleaner, more energy efficient furnaces and things like that. That's pretty good. I mean, and that's also some stuff that I think some of the opposition parties have been getting at. I mean, those kind of local home improvement projects that we know are going to be that are going to be very big because there's a separate story, but there is kind of a lumber shortage, as that's kind of like brutally evidenced in in our neck of the woods, there was a $10,000 mm-hmm. lumber heist at the Home Hardware on Wellington a couple of weeks ago. So
yeah, it's hard to believe it's worth that much, but I mean, such are the times, right? That's
mm-hmm.
the value mm-hmm. just is seesawing on certain goods.
Lumber's definitely. Yeah, no, definitely. So there's also they're going to hike the federal minimum wage to $15, excluding places that have a minimum wage bigger than $15, or is that $15 already? $3 billion for long-term care. Let's see what else. $2.5 billion to accelerate affordable housing, which is something like we're actually seeing. Like come forward pretty quick. Like it's been less than a year since, you know, it was made public about the Parkview supportive housing project. Now that is going to, you know, start becoming a reality. Last month it was announced the County of Wellington was going to buy 65 Delhi for a temporary shelter there. And I think that is coming to council in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this affordable housing is, I mean, it is big money at the federal level, of course, but we're seeing this actualized pretty quickly on a local level too.
Yep. So there's a little bit for everybody by the sounds of it. And they have borrowed, or I wouldn't say stolen, but they've borrowed quite a bit from other parties as well. I don't know if it's to get a definitive buy-in from them, particularly the NDP.
Yeah.
NDP have said that they're not going to vote against this, and they're using the pandemic as the excuse to prop up the government. But there are some things that are obviously, like the $15 minimum wage plank mm-hmm. is straight out of the NDP, but from a few years ago, right? Because I think the consensus is that it probably should be 20 now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that $15 minimum wage is a bit retro. It feels like it's from years ago now.
Right? Well, the last time the Task Force for Poverty Elimination here revised the living wage number. It was $16.95, and that was 2018 or 19. I think it was.
I thought you meant like 17th century, like because that's what it's like, right? In 1695, yeah. But
no, it's $16.95 an hour,
and that's bare bones. That's just like to meet your needs, right?
So, yeah.
So 20 is not, but it's obviously going to get support. I don't know. There was an amendment that was supposed to go today, block at a sub-amendment yesterday, which obviously I think we would have heard if it hadn't gone through. And the Conservatives had an amendment today,
mm-hmm.
which will probably, you know, fizzle, but the entire package isn't voted on until Monday, right? So
so
there's still a bit more time for them and us, I suppose, to pick it apart. What was the Conservative thing? Was it to do with ramping up the vaccine rollout or something? In the name of jobs and the economy, it's like it just seems kind of okay.
Well, their
like,
point
they will
was
argue
like
that the vaccine is being rolled out, right? Like,
right. Well, their point was also that there needed to be like the federal government needs to basically free the beast in the economic recovery, and that includes like not putting cuffs on the resource sector, which. I mean, it's not going to happen. I mean, also, we have to reconcile with the fact that the resource sector isn't exactly booming itself, regardless of whatever.
I'm going to say three different economists, bits and pieces, speaking from different, you know, economists are economists, but some of them from banks and whatnot. And there didn't seem to be anything overly negative. They all seem to think,
yeah,
you know, budget or no budget, things are going to catch fire once COVID is behind us. So I guess this falls within the scope of what they're trying to do here. It's like, let's get the pandemic behind us. Let's do all that we can. And then we are just going to like amp it and ramp it right up. And then
it's
their oyster. So, right.
I mean, it's really hard start because buying
things again, like, I don't know, luxury goods, which is another one of those, the syntax thing, right?
Yeah. Well, it's really hard because, I mean, even the federal government is sort of struggling with it because it turns out the deficit was $30 billion less for 2020-2021 fiscal. But then they added $30 billion to the deficit for next year, which, I mean, in many respects, this is like a placeholder budget, which makes you wonder why they couldn't release a placeholder budget last year, but neither here nor there. But it is very hard to like really get angry at this budget because a lot of it is just kind of meat and potatoes, and the rest of it is just we're going to wait and see. We're going to do what we can to keep the economy on simmer until we can get everybody vaccinated and then away. Mm-hmm. It's really not that complicated, fortunately or unfortunately.
Well, yeah, and I guess the anger would be coming from the right because there's no effort to pay down no debt or deficit, right? They're assuming that the economic stimulation will do that, but there's no hard plan for. It was the debt now, 1.4 trillion or something, and mm-hmm. this is a half a trillion in spending. So that all of those numbers are just getting higher, and if you're of the, let's say, conservative persuasion, there is no plan for that. It's just we're going to make that happen, and then the economy will happen, and then that will take care of it. But as we know, that's never happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or sorry, at least not in recent history. But anyway.
Speaking of things that have never happened, Derek Chauvin, the police officer that was charged with the murder of George Floyd, he was convicted on all three counts, which was even more surprising: second degree murder, third degree murder, and second degree manslaughter, which could result in, I mean, if the maximum is applied, it could result in over 60 years in prison on each for all the counts combined. It's probably unlikely he's going to get 6 years in prison. The sentencing recommendation is for 12 and a half. But, you know, on the one hand, it is a positive sign. We had a police officer who was held to account for his over-the-top use of force. At the same time, it's not going away. Before I let Scotty have a go, I found this incredible when CNN reported on it yesterday, that from January 2008 to May 25th, 2020, 62.6% of all use of 64.6% of all use of force involved a black suspect. Since George Floyd was killed, the use of force number is down to 62.6. So after George Floyd was murdered, the use of force against black people was still disproportional. It only went down 2%, which is probably why Attorney General Merrick Garland is going to be investigating the Minneapolis police force now. Anyway, your thoughts.
Yeah, it sounds like the investigation kicked off like this. I'm not sure if that was planned. The investigation kicking off like on the same day, the federal investigation, right? So, mm-hmm. and that's not just of the deaths, but the protester suppression that happened in the wake of Floyd's death, where they just let loose on people who were peacefully protesting as well. So there's mm-hmm. a few angles to that. But yeah, and as you're saying, like. And I'm sure you heard about the it wasn't in Minnesota, but in Ohio, the young girl that was shot and killed by the police, like as the verdict was being read. Mm-hmm. And of course, that needs to be unwound as well. But an interesting stat that came out of this, because normally you get a decision like this and then they go to everyone under the sun for commentary, right? Because that's usually how it works, because the story, it's not over, but it's like, you know, what are your thoughts? It's street or central. And one of the most interesting points that was made by somebody who I, again, didn't catch the name, but community activists seemed like she knew what she was talking about. She said that over the past 20 years up until until George Floyd was killed. And I think I remember what it was. Her partner was killed by police in similar circumstances. The usual. You're just being black or a BIPOC person and you are dead, having not done anything particularly wrong other than forged $20 bill or whatever it is, right? So she said that within that time frame in 20 years that 470 people were killed in the hands of police in Minnesota alone. That's just Minnesota. That is not an American statistic. That is within that scope.
Yeah.
Almost 500 people.
Yeah.
Right? And some of that had, well, there was the other when the case was going on too, right? The young man that was pulled over for on a warrant or something, mm-hmm. dead, mm-hmm. just gone, right?
I mean, that's an incredible Dante Wright. Yeah, I mean, that is an incredible thing where, yeah, he's pulled over. I think he was pulled over for having expired tags on his plate. They go to his window. They see he has an air freshener on the rearview mirror, which is against the law in Minnesota for some reason.
distracted driving or some nonsense there.
I mean, I would love to see the stats on how many people are killed because they're distracted by their air freshener. But leaving that aside, you know, they do check him out. They discover he has a warrant out for, I think it was carrying a gun with that, an unregistered weapon. And they go to arrest him, and, you know, he starts struggling, and the one officer, who was the training officer on scene, she gets out her gun. She thinks she's getting out her taser. And there are a couple of things that are deeply, deeply wrong with this. Number one is, the taser is holstered on the left, the gun is holstered on the right. And of course, she's a righty, so that's the dominant hand. So, I mean, that's a big problem to begin with, that the mm-hmm. thing that's on your, like, on your dominant side is the one you're going to reach for. But then, you know, I have held, like, an actual handgun. It is not a light thing. It is it's not like a taser. I have held one of those, like, those taser weapons too. It is very, very light. It's plastic. It's almost like a toy. Mm-hmm. In terms of,
there's no heft. Yeah,
exactly. There's no heft. Not the same with a gun. I'm curious how she was able to mistake the two. If it was an honest mistake, as she seems to think, how do you, as a 26-year career officer, make this kind of, like, just fundamental mistake? It's just, it's incredibly impossible to believe. Even if you have any sympathy at all for the police, or for this police officer in particular, it's just, it sounds so messed up that you go for your taser and you pull out your gun. Nobody's gonna believe that, and in fact, nobody is believing it. And that's a real problem.
Well, it is a massive part of the problem, and in that there's always an excuse,
mm-hmm.
and that excuse is always, well, up until now, or for the most part, is just accepted, mm-hmm. right? That it's like, oh, I thought it was this, or, you know, you're carrying whatever around, a bag of Skittles, and, oh, it's this, or you're walking strangely like that, the young man, right?
Or it's your, like, hood's up. Yeah.
Or your hood's up. Or it's like, there's always, always, always an excuse. And the time for excuses is obviously long past. Now, I mean, getting back to George Floyd, and I was thinking about this a lot, because the footage, which is difficult to watch, making the rounds, and how, you know, the defense and the prosecution, we could go full Law and Order on this as to how it went. But the fact that that film existed,
mm-hmm.
it was a young woman that was just shopping or whatever, right? With her sister or cousin or niece or whatever it was. I can't remember. But had that not been filmed, had they not had that evidence,
mm-hmm.
you have to wonder how this would have gone down. If mm-hmm. if that hadn't been as clearly documented as it was, and it was strictly the bystanders, as we saw, and throughout the case, you know, things probably would have been a hell of a lot different if that hadn't existed. And I think that that is probably one of the key differences of today, is that everything, you know, on the one hand, everything being so well documented, is that really necessary in our lives? And on the other hand, it's like, there is probably no way that that conviction would have gone down the way it did if it wasn't for this. I don't think so. I mean, you spend a lot of time out in the community filming. It's like,
yeah,
but that's the thing, though, is that anybody can do that now, right? It's sort of civic eyes on what's going on. And the police hate it generally, is because, as we know, there are body cameras tend to fail at certain moments. They work perfectly fine, and then something happened. Mm-hmm. There was some static, or a piece of mud landed on the lens. We don't know what happened, right? So people have deep and every reason to be skeptical about anything, and I mean anything, that the police have to say in situations like this, because it's so chronic, and, you know, this verdict is something, but is it the moment of change? Is it the turning point where it's like, we see differences in policing, it's not just going to happen because of this. They need systemic, like, down to the roots change. And will that happen just because of this verdict, and particularly in America? I don't
I hate to be once again the doubter, but I don't see this just causing sea change overnight.
Well, to go back to the Makia Bryant thing really quick, a lot has been made about how she had a knife, and it looked like she was stabbing somebody else. And again, it doesn't excuse the action. You know, the police officer still shot her in the back. Mm-hmm. But somebody posted on Twitter like this supercut of, you know, police officers just like wrestling with people, just like outright wrestling with people.
Yeah.
Like wrestling to the ground. People who were like resisting arrest. People who were fighting back. And it is brutal to watch. But the thing you were seeing is everyone they are wrestling with is white. Meanwhile, if they see someone who is black, if they're resisting,
yep,
even if they're not resisting, that video with Second Lieutenant Karen Nazaro, where he just, you know, he drives a little bit further to make sure he's in a well-lit area before he stops. He drives like a mile before he pulls over. As soon as the cops get out of the car, the guns come out. And that, you're right, that like that has to change. That instinct that when you see black or brown, the reflex is to pull your gun.
Yes,
that's where the change begins.
Or you can be like Rittenhouse when you have a gun and you're waving to the cops and just walking away.
Right.
And people are like, yep, hey, that dude there, the white dude with the rifle, just shot some people and he walks away. It's like, this is the problem.
Yeah.
Right? It's the judgment. It's not the police job anywhere to judge people, right?
Yeah.
You fix the situation, whatever it is, right? And then it is the job of the law to decide. It is not, and this is the problem with the judge jury approach, but not only that, it's through a systemic racist lens.
Right.
There's no arguing that. I mean, even with this is unusual, the president chiming in.
Yeah.
This sustain on the nation's soul, or whatever the quote was. I think that was the direct quote. It's like, that is really unusual. And I guess, who was it made the comment, and you'll know, I can't remember off the top of my head, that they thought was going to throw the trial because she said something before.
Oh, Maxine Waters, yeah.
Yes, Maxine Waters, exactly.
Yeah. Who Republicans, like, overwhelmingly voted to censure. Meanwhile, they have Marjorie Taylor Greene in the ranks trying to start a KKK caucus, basically.
Yeah,
but
caucus, yes.
All of that is future fodder, because this is far from over. We'll have to take a break here. You are listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
And that was our Royal Cat Records pick of the week. Royal Cat Records 21 Macdonnell. Pick up only these days in lockdown, shutdown times. And that song, definitely on vinyl, from 1985. The dance sequence of my generation. From the Breakfast Club. The song was We Are Not Alone by Carla DeVito. And I bet you didn't know that. I mean, everybody sort of knows that song that's seen that movie, but Carla DeVito.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. No relation to Danny, it would seem. I did. But
good luck in Trivia Pursuit this weekend, everyone.
Yes. So, remember that. Who sang that song? Who did that thing there? Yeah. So, but anyway, that dance sequence, as we know, parodied widely, including by a young AOC when she was in college. So there is a political connection to this.
Well, that's what's important.
Other than all the Gen Xers getting their jabs this week.
Yeah.
Oh, what a miserable bunch we are, eh?
Yeah.
He laughed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of Gen Xers being a pain in the butt, we did an interview, it was almost 2 weeks ago, and we've been crossing our fingers on nothing really radical happens with China ever since. But I mean, this is the way kind of, you know, people fit you in when they're available sometimes. And Michael Chong is a very busy man. He is the MP, longtime MP for Wellington Halton Hills. He is also the foreign affairs critics for the Conservative Party, and he has been hitting very hard on China, and so much that they sanctioned him. And we're going to talk about that and what being sanctioned by China means to his everyday life. And we're going to talk about the plight of the two Michaels, the Uyghur genocide there, plus we're going to talk a bit about anti-Asian racism and how being tough on China can sometimes inadvertently stoke that stuff up. And we'll just I think I've queued that up enough, so let me just reach over here to the old tape recorder and press play. And here is Michael Chong. Well, Michael Chong, thank you so much for your time today and for joining us.
Great to be here, Adam.
I want to start with you were recently among numerous Canadian politicians and people who were sanctioned by China. And I've heard you comment on that, but, you know, can you explain to our listeners, you know, like, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean to be sanctioned by China? I mean, what kind of time commitment is that for you?
Well, I'm the only Canadian politician sanctioned, but I've been sanctioned along with elected officials from the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe. The sanction essentially bans Chinese citizens from and companies from doing business with me and bans me from visiting China. I have no plans to, I had no plans to visit China, and I have no business ties to China. And so from a practical point of view, they will have little effect on me. That said, these sanctions should be treated seriously. They are an attempt by China to silence debate and criticisms of its violations of fundamental human rights and their violations of international law. And so in that context, I see the sanction against me as a badge of pride, a badge of honor. It means that our criticism that I and others have been leveling at China for these violations of human rights and international law are effective.
Right. And I think that's sort of the key to this is, I mean, and maybe this has to do with like high level diplomatic stuff that that I or anyone listening as an average person may not be able to get to. But I mean, it does. It's one of these things like on the surface, it seems kind of meaningless. But in terms of like the deeper diplomatic meaning for these things, this has a lot of meaning that they've singled you out, Michael Chong, one of 338 for sanction.
Yeah, it's a warning to others that if they speak up, that they may very well be sanctioned. I don't think this clumsy tactic on part of China is going to work. In fact, I think it's going to do quite the opposite. It's only emboldened us to continue to speak up on these issues. And frankly, it's drawn a lot of attention to China's violations of human rights, their gross violation of human rights against the Uyghur people, their genocide that they're perpetrating against the 12 million Uyghur Muslims that are living in Xinjiang province in Western China. It's drawing attention to the fact that they are violating international law in violating the treaty, the 1984 treaty that guarantees Hong Kong's autonomy for 50 years. So I don't think their tactics are going to work. And I think it's going to do quite the opposite.
You make an interesting point, though, that there are, I mean, there's a variety of things going on in China right now with the genocide against the Uyghurs, with anti-democratic hammer coming down in Hong Kong, the diplomatic relations, I mean, with Korving and Spavor.
Michael Korving and Michael Spavor.
Thank you. I guess that's why we just say the two Michaels. But, you know, it just seems like it's a bit overwhelming, isn't it? Like, on the other hand, it's kind of easy to understand. We're not really sure what tactic to take with China because we're trying to negotiate with China on numerous fronts. And it's not just a Canadian thing, but it's an international thing, too, that there's so much there's so much going on with China right now. It's hard to settle on the one thing or where to focus our diplomatic efforts.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that. I think that the relationship between Canada and China, as well as between other countries and China, is a complex relationship. Unlike the threats we faced from the former Soviet Union, China is very integrated into the global economy in a way that the Soviet Union wasn't. It's also integrated in other ways that the Soviet Union wasn't. The Soviet Union was not only blocked off, largely isolated economically from the Western alliance, it also was isolated physically. There was literally a wall.
Yeah.
The Iron Curtain between East and West that divided much of Europe. That's not the case with China. And so in that sense, it's a much different kind of relationship than the one we faced when we were threatened by the Soviet Union. That said, I think it's been clear for a number of years now that China has become a threat to our citizens. You mentioned Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor that have been wrongfully detained now for over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
They have been a threat to our economic interests. Several years ago, they arbitrarily they blocked the export of Canadian canola, pork, and beef products into China, punishing Canadian farmers. And they are increasingly a threat to our values, our belief in human rights. They're a threat to the rules-based international order in their flagrant violations of the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas, in their violation of the 1984 Joint Declaration between Britain and Hong Kong, and in their violation of the Genocide Convention. And so I think that the government has been slow to acknowledge these threats. I think they finally have come around in the last 6 months, the Liberal government come around to acknowledging that China now is a threat, but yet they have no comprehensive framework to address these threats and protect Canadian interests and values.
I guess along with that, though, is, and again, this is, you know, my perspective as a layman, but, you know, what can we do? I think a lot of us in Canada think we can play amongst the world powers. But I mean, the situation with Meng Wanzhou shows that just how susceptible we are to sort of being trampled underneath the foot of these powers. We pick her up at the airport because the United States asks us to. China gets mad at us, even though we are just executing the diplomatic and judicial requests of another country. It just seems like, and this may be an unanswerable question in a certain respect, but I mean, how does Canada stand up against a powerhouse like China? And I guess where is the current foreign affairs plan falling behind in that regard?
Well, it's clear that Canada is not a superpower and that China is. China's economy is 7 times larger than that of Canada's. It also is a country with some 50 times, 40 times the population of Canada's. And so it is a superpower in its own right, and Canada is not. That said, Canada working in concert with like-minded allies and partners, particularly with like-minded democracies, is powerful. If we band together with democracies like Japan and Australia, India and the Indo-Pacific region, if we band together with democracies in Europe, with the United Kingdom, and with the world's great democracy to the south of us, the United States, then, you know, we are powerful and we will be effective. And so that's the starting point, that Canada needs to act in concert multilaterally with our allies in order to counter these threats. The problem is that too often the Liberal government doesn't act multilaterally. Too often it's unilaterally alone and not taking action. And I'll just give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. Canada is part of the Five Eyes intelligence network. These are five countries that since the Second World War have been partners together in sharing intelligence and in protecting national security. The five countries are Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand. Four of the Five Eyes, that being the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand, have decided that Huawei is a threat to their national security, a threat to the theft of intellectual property, and have made a decision to either ban or restrict Huawei from their 5G infrastructure. Canada is unilaterally alone in not joining these four other democratic allies in making a decision to ban Huawei from our 5G infrastructure. There are other examples. In the Indo-Pacific region, there is an emerging alliance of democracies that are working together to counter some of the threats that China is posing. These four democracies are Australia, India, Japan, and the United States. Canada is alone in not participating in this alliance of democracies, something that we've been calling on the government to do. So those are just two examples of where the government is not acting multilaterally to defend our interests.
Is there not a concern, though, and maybe this plays into the whole vote a couple of weeks ago to call the genocide a genocide, but is there not a fear? And I mean, that's standing up to the fear of it is what separates the proverbial men from the boys, of course. But I mean, all we did with Meng Wanzhou was take her into custody, executing an international warrant, like I said. But if we were to, as you indicated, you know, say no to Huawei, China has already shown that they're kind of retaliatory. And if there is a retaliation against, I mean, say they pick up another couple of Canadians for quote unquote espionage, you know, is there not maybe a rational reason why the government might be currently afraid of provoking China? And I guess how do we overcome that?
Well, we can't sacrifice our fundamental principles that our democracy is based on in order to defend our interests and to defend our values. We have to always abide by these fundamental principles, a belief in the rules-based international order, a belief in the rule of law, essentially a belief that, you know, the prime minister cannot interfere in the administration of justice and in judicial proceedings that are taking place with respect to Meng Wanzhou in Vancouver.
Yeah.
A belief in upholding human rights, both here and abroad. The minute we are silent about these fundamental principles, authoritarianism and fear win out the day. And the reason why that we can't allow that to happen is that in these early decades of the 21st century, it's clear that there is a great rivalry shaping up between two very different systems of governance. Mm. One is the system of governance that has long held the world together since the end of the Second World War. That's a belief in democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. A system of beliefs that's been enshrined in the rules-based international order, enshrined in treaties, enshrined in multilateral institutions. An emerging rivalry now is coming up because of China's increasing authoritarianism. And China strongly believes, as do other authoritarian states like Russia, that its model of governance is superior and would like to export that model of governance, not just in the Indo-Pacific region, but also throughout multilateral institutions. And so we cannot allow that system of governance to become the dominant system of governance in the 21st century. And that prevention of that system from winning out starts by standing up for the principles that we have long held dear, principles that are universal, principles that have withstood the test of time.
I don't think anyone would necessarily disagree with that in theory. I just think, on the other hand, the case of the two Michaels, they have families who just want their family members to come home. And I guess, you know, and this, I don't expect you to have all the answers, of course, or anyone in government to have all the answers. Just the consequences do fall on the shoulders of specific people, right?
Yeah, that's right. But I argue that by being silent,
right,
we are essentially doing what China wants us to do, which is to acquiesce to their authoritarianism, to their and to their violations of international law and human rights. And in doing so, we only, in our silence, we only embolden them to go further. We only confirm to them that that style of governance, that kind of decision making is going to produce results. And that's why I believe that we can't be silent, that we have to speak up. We have to speak up based on these fundamental principles. We have to speak up to defend our interests. And if we do that in concert with other democratic allies, I think China will understand, hopefully, that this kind of behavior cannot continue and that they're going to have to moderate themselves, not just in Indo-Pacific, but globally.
Are we seeing a start of that then?
Yes, I think we are. I think if you looked back a decade ago, democracies were not working in concert on China. I think we're in the last several years, particularly in the last year and a half, we're now starting to see democracies come together and work in concert with respect to China. One recent example was the decision by democracies like Canada, the United States, and European democracies to put sanctions on Chinese officials for gross violations of human rights and their genocide against the Uyghur Muslim minority in Western China.
Yeah, it just seems like the appearance of diplomats from the United States, the EU, at the second trial, and the fact that the Chinese courts, which are, I think it's 99% vote to convict, so it's not especially shocking when that happens, but the fact that they didn't render a decision on that day and have yet to render a decision as we're recording this, is this an indication? I mean, it's hard to telepath the minds of what's going on in Beijing, but I mean, are they starting to feel that pressure, do you think?
I think so. I think China is worried about growing international condemnation of their diplomacy. I think that's the reason why they're targeting elected officials for sanctions. But I don't think any of their pushback is going to work. I think, my observation of history is that democracies are slow forms of governance relative to authoritarian systems. In authoritarian systems of government, decisions are made very efficiently and very quickly. It's the very nature of authoritarianism, because one or a handful of people have all the power. Democracies inherently are decision-making systems which require the consent of many, many people in order to make decisions. And by that fact, they are much slower than authoritarian systems. And so, democracies were slow to react to the threat of China in recent years. But history demonstrates that when democracies start to work in concert, they've always prevailed. And I expect that the same thing will happen in the long run here. We have to be confident, though, about the principles on which our democracies are based. Mm-hmm. And I think there's been a bit of a crisis of confidence in Western democracies in recent years. It's been a very trying time for our American friends south of the border over the last 4 years, 5 years, with the previous, not just with the previous administration, but with all the division, political divisions that we've been seeing in the United States. And so it has led to, a questioning of the democratic institutions that have endured for so long. But we've had crises before in democracies, and we've come out of it and come out of it stronger, and I'm confident that the same thing will happen here.
Well, that's to be continued. I do want to focus on one other aspect, because I did notice you talked about this in the House a little while ago, was about anti-Asian racism that we're seeing. I know that a lot of that has been tied to certain figures who use expressions like the China virus to talk about COVID-19. But it does seem, as sort of international friction with China is going up, we're also seeing that backlash to Canadians here at home, who, not just people of Chinese, there was a young woman here in Guelph who is, her parents are Filipino, but because she's Asian Canadian, she gets it too. I'm wondering, how do you balance the criticism of China when some people hear that criticism and take it to an unacceptable level, which is to try and paint our citizens of Asian descent and you turn that into racist language and extremist language.
Yeah. So, you know, the starting point is that our criticism is not of the Chinese people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Chinese people are part of an ancient civilization that goes back millennia, a civilization that has contributed greatly to humanity. Our fight, our criticism, our quarrel is with the Chinese communist leadership in Beijing. It is they, the leadership, the government, the authorities in Beijing, that are the threat to Canada, that are violating international law, that are violating fundamental human rights with the genocide of the Uyghur people. That's where our quarrel is with. So it's not with the Chinese people in China, it's with their leadership. It's with the government of China.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that's important to point out is that, you know, criticism of China and its leadership is fair game. China is threatening Canada, and we can't be silent in the face of that criticism. But we also have to ensure that we're vigilant against any discrimination and racism directed toward Canadians of Asian descent. You know, and as someone, as someone who is of half Asian descent, I'm very proud of my Asian roots, but we have to be vigilant about calling out the hatred and discrimination against Asian Canadians when we see it. And that's what I've always done throughout my career, and not just prejudice and discrimination leveled against Asian Canadians, but Canadians of any race, religion, or creed. You know, we live in a democracy, and you know, as I said earlier in our conversation, we have to stand up for these fundamental principles, one of which is a belief in human rights and freedoms. In fact, it's so important that we have a charter of rights and freedoms where we enshrined these fundamental principles, as have other democracies. And when we see threats to these fundamental rights and freedoms in the form of people attacking, assaulting, spitting on, verbally attacking people based on their race, religion, or creed, we as political leaders have a responsibility to stand up and denounce that, saying that it has no place in a free and democratic society.
I think all of that is right, but I think it helps to hear it from someone in your position. I am having one eye on the clock here, so before we completely run out of time, we're always in the media carefully tracking when the next election is. And I mean, you've had your seat for a while. I mean, you are still a youthful looking man, so you may still be enjoying the politics, but have you given any thought to re-election yet?
Yeah, I have decided to represent in the next election, and each and every election, it's, you know, a clean slate. You have to re-earn the support, re-earn the trust of the people of Wellington County and Halton Region, and that's exactly what I intend to do in the next election.
All right, perfect. We got that on the record, and I don't know if I'm the first, but I will pretend I am, and I'll just finish up by saying, Michael Chong, thank you so much for giving us all your time today.
It's great to be with you, Adam.
So once again, that was Michael Chong, and we are glad to have had a chance to talk to him. And just to, you know, to all the haters out there, this isn't a conservative bashing show. We have everyone on. So,
yes,
there.
We seem to have that reputation, but we've not earned it at all. So I wish people would stop saying that. Anyway, all are welcome. We extend that all of the time, but yet somehow. So
we are your friend.
Give us a call and we're going to tell you how to do that in short order.
Yeah, give us a call. Although we're not at the station now, so maybe just send us an email. So
mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. As always, if you want to listen to us again, you can download the show every Monday from our website or at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. You can stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com, or on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. I am on social media on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can find my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. You can call me at 519. No, I'm just kidding. best way to find stuff out about CFRU other than listening to 93.3 is to check out CFRU.ca,
for scheduling information and everything that's going on. So do that and everything will be revealed. Okay, maybe not everything, but
anyway. I was gonna say, including the caramel secret. Call send Scotty a DM for the caramel secret.
Send me a caramel bar, I'll be your friend for life at this point.
Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back, of course, next Thursday at 5 p.m. for another stupendous episode of Open Sources Guelph, and we will see you then.